This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Blood Promise, a Vampire Academy novel by Rochelle Mead. Read by Emily Schaefer. Once when I was in ninth grade, I had to write a paper on a poem. One of the lines was, "If your eyes weren't open, you wouldn't know the difference between dreaming and waking." It hadn't meant much to me at the time. After all, there'd been a guy in class that I liked. So how could I be expected to pay attention to literary analysis? Now, 3 years later, I understood the poem perfectly. Because lately, my life really did seem like it was on the precipice of being a dream. There were days I thought I'd wake up and discover that recent events in my life hadn't actually happened. Surely I must be a princess in an enchanted sleep. Any day now, this dream, no, nightmare, would end, and I'd get my prince and happy ending. But there was no happy ending to be found, at least not in the foreseeable future. And my prince? Well, that was a long story. My prince had been turned into a vampire, a Strigoi to be specific. In my world, there are two kinds of vampires who exist in secrecy from humans. The Moroi are living vampires, good vampires who wield elemental magic and don't kill when seeking the blood they need to survive. Strigoi are undead vampires, immortal and twisted, who kill when they feed. Moroi are born. Strigoi are made, forcibly or by choice, through evil means. And Dimitri, the guy I loved, had been made a Strigoi against his will. He'd been turned during a battle, an epic rescue mission that I'd been part of as well. Strigoi had kidnapped Moroi and Dom Pierce from the school I attended, and we'd set out with others to save them. Dom Pierce are half vampire and half human, gifted with human strength and hardiness, and Moroi reflexes and senses. Dom Pierce trained to become guardians, the elite bodyguards who protect Moroi. That's what I am. That's what Dimitri had been. After his conversion, the rest of the Moroi world had considered him dead. And to a certain extent, he was. Those who returned Strigoi lost all sense of the goodness and life they'd had before. Even if they hadn't turned by choice, it didn't matter. They would still become evil and cruel, just like all Strigoi. The person they'd been was gone. And honestly, it was easier to imagine them moving on to heaven or the next life than to picture them out stalking the night and taking victims. But I hadn't been able to forget Dimitri, or accept that he was essentially dead. He was the man I loved, the man with whom I'd been so perfectly in sync that it was hard to know where I ended and he began. My heart refused to let him go. Even if he was technically a monster, he was still out there somewhere. I also hadn't forgotten a conversation he and I had once had. We'd both agreed that we'd rather be dead, truly dead, than walk the world as Strigoi. And once I'd had my mourning time for the goodness he'd lost, I decided I had to honor his wishes. Even if he no longer believed in them, I had to find him. I had to kill him and free his soul from that dark, unnatural state. I knew it was what the Dimitri I had loved would have wanted. Killing Strigoi isn't easy, though. They're insanely fast and strong. They have no mercy. I'd killed a number of them already. Pretty crazy for someone who was freshly 18. And I knew taking on Dimitri would be my greatest challenge, both physically and emotionally. In fact, the emotional consequences had kicked in as soon as I made my decision. Going after Dimitri had meant doing a few life-altering things, and that wasn't even counting the fact that fighting him could very likely result in the loss of my life. I was still in school, only a handful of months away from graduating and becoming a full-fledged guardian. Every day I stuck around at St. Vladimir's Academy, a remote protected school for Maroy and Dompiers, meant one more day was going by in which Dimitri was still out there, living in the state he'd never wanted. I loved him too much to allow that. So I'd had to leave school early and go out among humans, abandoning the world I'd lived in nearly my entire life. Leaving had also meant abandoning one other thing, or rather, a person. My best friend Lyssa, also known as Veselissa Dragomir. Lyssa was Maroy, the last in a royal line. I'd been slated to be her guardian when we graduated, and my decision to hunt Dimitri had pretty much destroyed that future with her. I'd had no choice but to leave her. Aside from our friendship, Lyssa and I had a unique connection. Each Maroy specializes in a type of elemental magic, earth, air, water, or fire. Until recently, we'd believed there were only those four elements. Then we discovered a fifth, spirit. That was Lyssa's element, and with so few spirit users in the world, we hardly knew anything about it. For the most part, it seemed to be tied to psychic powers. Lyssa wielded amazing compulsion, the ability to exert her will on almost anyone. She could also heal, and that's where things got a little strange between us. You see, I technically died in the car accident that killed her family. Lyssa had brought me back from the world of the dead without realizing it, creating a psychic bond between us. Ever since then, I was always aware of her presence and thoughts. I could tell what she was thinking and feel when she was in trouble. We had also recently discovered I could see ghosts and spirits who hadn't yet left this world, something I found disconcerting and struggled to block out. The whole phenomenon was called being shadow-kissed. Our shadow-kissed bond made me the ideal choice to protect Lyssa, since I would instantly know if she was in trouble. I'd promised to protect her my whole life. But then Dimitri, tall, gorgeous, fierce Dimitri, had changed it all. I'd been faced with that horrible choice. Continue to protect Lyssa, or free Dimitri's soul? Choosing between them had broken my heart, leaving an ache in my chest and tears in my eyes. My parting with Lyssa had been agonizing. We'd been best friends since kindergarten, and my departure was a shock for both of us. To be fair, she'd never seen it coming. I'd kept my romance with Dimitri a secret. He was my instructor, 7 years older than me, and had been assigned to be her guardian as well. As such, he and I had tried hard to fight our attraction, knowing we had to focus on Lyssa more than anything else, and that we'd also get in a fair amount of trouble for our student-teacher relationship. But being kept from Dimitri, even though I'd agreed to it, had caused me to build up a lot of unspoken resentment toward Lyssa. I probably should have talked to her about it, and explained my frustration over having my entire life planned out. It didn't seem fair, somehow, that while Lyssa was free to live and love however she wanted, I would always have to sacrifice my own happiness to ensure that she was protected. She was my best friend, though, and I couldn't bear the thought of upsetting her. Lyssa was particularly vulnerable because using spirit had the nasty side effect of driving people insane. So I'd sat on my feelings until they finally exploded, and I left the academy, and her, behind, for good. One of the ghosts I'd seen, Mason, a friend who had been killed by Strigoi, had told me Dimitri had returned to his homeland, Siberia. Mason's soul had found peace and left this world shortly thereafter, without giving me any clues about where in Siberia Dimitri might have gone. So I'd had to set out there blindly, braving a world of humans and a language I didn't know in order to fulfill the promise I'd made to myself. After a few weeks on my own, I had finally made it to St. Petersburg. I was still looking, still floundering, but determined to find him, even though I dreaded it at the same time. Because if I really did pull this insane plan off, if I actually managed to kill the man I loved, it would mean Dimitri would truly be gone from the world. And I honestly wasn't sure I could go on in a world like that. None of it seems real. Who knows? Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's actually happening to someone else. Maybe it's something I imagined. Maybe soon I'm going to wake up and find everything fixed with Lyssa and Dimitri. we'll all be together. And he'll be there to smile and hold me and tell me everything's going to be okay. Maybe all of this really has been a dream. But I don't think so. Chapter 1. I was being followed. It was kind of ironic considering the way I'd been following others for the last few weeks. At least it wasn't a Strigoi. I would have already known. A recent effect of my being shadow-kissed was the ability to sense the undead. Through bouts of nausea, unfortunately. Still, I appreciated my body's early warning system and was relieved my stalker tonight wasn't an insanely fast, insanely vicious vampire. I'd fought enough of those recently and kind of wanted a night off. I had to guess my follower was a Dompier like me, probably one from the club. Admittedly, this person was moving a little less stealthily than I would have expected of a Dompier. Footsteps were clearly audible against the pavement of the dark side streets I was traveling on, and once, I'd caught a brief glimpse of a shadowy figure. Still, considering my rash actions tonight, a Dompier was the most likely culprit. It had all started earlier at the Nightingale. That wasn't the club's true name, only a translation. Its real name was something Russian that was beyond my ability to pronounce. Back in the U.S., the Nightingale was well known among rich Moroi who traveled abroad, and now I could understand why. No matter what time of the day it was, people at the Nightingale dressed like they were at an imperial ball. And, well, the whole place actually kind of looked like something from the old royal days of Russia, with ivory walls covered in gold scrollwork and molding. It reminded me a lot of the Winter Palace, a royal residence left over from when Russia had still been ruled by czars. I'd toured it upon first arriving in St. Petersburg. At the Nightingale, elaborate chandeliers filled with real candles glittered in the air, lighting up the gold decor so that even in dim lighting, the whole establishment sparkled. There was a large dining room filled with velvet-draped tables and booths, as well as a lounge and bar area where people could mingle. Late in the evening, a band would set up in there and couples would hit the dance floor. I hadn't bothered with the Nightingale when I arrived in the city a couple weeks ago. I'd been arrogant enough to think I could find Moroi right away who could direct me to Dmitri's hometown in Siberia. With no other clues about where Dmitri had gone in Siberia, heading to the town he'd grown up in had been my best chance of getting closer to him. Only I didn't know where it was, which was why I was trying to find Moroi to help me. There were a number of Dompier towns and communes in Russia, but hardly any in Siberia, which made me believe most local Moroi would be familiar with his birthplace. Unfortunately, it turned out that the Moroi who lived in human cities were very good at keeping themselves hidden. I checked what I thought were likely Moroi hangouts, only to come up empty. And without those Moroi, I had no answers. So I'd begun staking out the Nightingale, which wasn't easy. It was hard for an 18-year-old girl to blend into one of the city's most elite clubs. I'd soon found that expensive clothes and large enough tips went a long way toward helping me get by. The waitstaff had come to know me, and if they thought my presence was strange, they didn't say so and were happy to give me the corner table I always asked for. I think they thought I was the daughter of some tycoon or politician. Whatever my background, I had the money to be there, which was all they cared about. Even so, my first few nights there had been discouraging. The Nightingale might have been an elite hangout for Moroi, but was also frequented by humans. And at first, it had seemed those were the club's only patrons. Crowds grew larger as the night progressed, and in peering through the packed tables and people lingering at the bar, I'd seen no Moroi. The most notable thing I'd seen was a woman with long, platinum blonde hair walking into the lounge with a group of friends. For a moment, my heart had stopped. The woman had her back to me, but she had looked so much like Lyssa that I'd felt certain I'd been tracked down. The weird thing was, I didn't know whether to feel excited or horrified. I miss Lyssa so, so much, yet at the same time, I didn't want her involved in this dangerous trip of mine. Then the woman had turned around. It wasn't Lyssa. She wasn't even a Moroi, just a human. Slowly, my breathing returned to normal. Finally, a week or so ago, I'd had my first sighting. A group of Moroi women had come in for a late lunch, accompanied by two guardians, one male and one female, who sat dutifully and quietly at the table as their charges gossiped and laughed over afternoon champagne. Dodging those guardians had been the trickiest part. For those who knew what to look for, Maroi were easy to spot. Taller than most humans, pale and uber-slim. They also had a certain funny way of smiling and holding their lips in order to hide their fangs. Dompiers with our human blood appeared. Well, human. That was certainly how I looked to the untrained human eye. I was about 5'7", and whereas Maroi tended to have unreal, runway model bodies, mine was athletically built and curvy in the chest. Genetics from my unknown Turkish father and too much time in the sun had given me a light tan that paired well with long, nearly black hair and equally dark eyes. But those who had been raised in the Maroi world could spot me as a Dompier through close examination. I'm not sure what it was. Maybe some instinct that drew us to our own kind and recognized the mix of Maroi blood. Regardless, it was imperative that I appear human to those guardians so I didn't raise their alarms. I sat across the room in my corner, picking over caviar and pretending to read my book. For the record, I thought caviar was disgusting, but it seemed to be everywhere in Russia, particularly in the nice places. That and borscht, a kind of beet soup. I almost never finished my food at the Nightingale and would ravenously hit McDonald's afterwards, even though the Russian McDonald's restaurants were a bit different from what I'd grown up with in the U.S. Still, a girl had to eat. So it became a test of my skill, studying the Maroi when their guardians weren't watching. Admittedly, the guardians had little to fear during the day, since there would be no Strigoi out in the sun. But it was in guardian nature to watch everything, and their eyes continually swept the room. I had the same training and knew their tricks, so I managed to spy without detection. The women came back a lot, usually late in the afternoon. St. Vladimir's ran on a nocturnal schedule, but Maroi and Dompiers living out among humans either ran on a daylight schedule or something in between. For a while, I'd considered approaching them, or even their guardians. Something held me back. If anyone would know where a town of Dompiers lived, it would be male Maroi. Many of them visited Dompier towns in hopes of scoring easy Dompier girls. So I promised myself I'd wait another week to see if any guys came by. If not, I would see what kind of information the women could give me. At last, a couple days ago, two Maroi guys had started showing up. They tended to come later in the evening when the real partiers arrived. The men were about 10 years older than me and strikingly handsome, wearing designer suits and silk ties. They carried themselves like powerful, important people, and I would have bet good money that they were royal, particularly since each one came with a guardian. The guardians were always the same. Young men who wore suits to blend in but still carefully watched the room with that clever guardian nature. And there were women. Always women. The two Maroi were terrible flirts, continually scoping out and hitting on every woman in sight, even humans. But they never went home with any humans. That was a taboo still firmly ingrained in our world. Maroi had kept themselves separate from humans for centuries, fearing detection from a race that had grown so plentiful and powerful. Still, that didn't mean the men went home alone. At some point in the evening, Dompier women usually showed up, different ones, every night. They'd come in wearing low-cut dresses and lots of makeup, drinking heavily and laughing at everything the guys said, which probably wasn't even that funny. The women always wore their hair down, but every once in a while, they'd shift their heads in a way that showed their necks, which were heavily bruised. They were blood whores, Dompiers who let Maroi drink blood during sex. That was also a taboo, though it still happened in secret. I kept wanting to get one of the Maroi men alone, away from the watchful eyes of his guardian so that I could question him. But it was impossible. The guardians never left their Maroi unattended. I even attempted to follow them, but each time the group left the club, they'd almost immediately hop into a limousine, making it impossible for me to track them on foot. It was frustrating. I finally decided tonight that I'd have to approach the whole group and risk detection by the Dompiers. I didn't know if anyone from back home was actually looking for me, or if the group would even care who I was. Maybe I just had too high an opinion of myself. It was definitely possible that no one was actually concerned about a runaway dropout. But if anyone was looking for me, my description had undoubtedly been circulated amongst guardians worldwide. Even though I was now 18, I wouldn't have put it past some of the people I knew to haul me back to the U.S., and there was no way I could return until I'd found Dimitri. Then, just as I was considering my move on the group of Maroi, one of the Dompier women left the table to walk up to the bar. The guardians watched her, of course, but seemed confident about her safety and were more fixated on the Maroi. All this time, I'd been thinking Maroi men would be the best way to go to get information about a village of Dompiers and Bloodwhores. But what better way to locate this place than by asking an actual Bloodwhore? I strolled casually from my table and approached the bar, like I too was going to get a drink. I stood by as the woman waited for the bartender and studied her in my periphery. She was blonde and wore a long dress covered in silver sequins. I couldn't decide if it made my black satin sheath dress appear tasteful or boring. All of her movements, even the way she stood, were graceful like a dancer's. The bartender was helping others, and I knew it was now or never. I leaned toward her. "Do you speak English?" She jumped in surprise and looked over at me. She was older than I'd expected, her age cleverly concealed by makeup. Her blue eyes assessed me quickly, recognizing me as a Dompier. "Yes," she said warily. Even the one word carried a thick accent. "I'm looking for a town where lots of Dompiers live, out in Siberia. Do you know what I'm talking about? I need to find it." Again, she studied me, and I couldn't read her expression. She might as well have been a guardian for all that her face revealed. Maybe she trained at one time in her life. "Don't," she said bluntly. "Let it go." She turned away, her gaze back on the bartender as he made someone a blue cocktail adorned with cherries. I touched her arm. "I have to find it. There's a man..." I choked on the word. So much for my cool interrogation. Just thinking about Dimitri made my heart stick in my throat. How could I even explain it to this woman? That I was following a long-shot clue, seeking out the man I loved most in the world. A man who had been turned into a Strigoi and who I now needed to kill? Even now, I could perfectly picture the warmth of his brown eyes and the way his hands used to touch me. How could I do what I had crossed an ocean to do? "Focus, Rose. Focus." The Dompier woman looked back at me. "He's not worth it," she said, mistaking my meaning. No doubt she thought I was a lovesick girl chasing some boyfriend, which I supposed I kind of was.
"You're too young. It's not too late for you to avoid all that."
Her face might have been impassive, but there was sadness in her voice.
"Go do something else with your life. Stay away from that place."
"You know where it is," I exclaimed, too worked up to explain that I wasn't going there to be a blood whore. "Please, you have to tell me. I have to get there."
"Is there a problem?"
Both she and I turned and looked into the fierce face of one of the guardians. Damn, the Dompier woman might not be their top priority, but they would have noticed someone harassing her. The guardian was only a little older than me, and I gave him a sweet smile. I might not be spilling out of my dress like this other woman, but I knew my short skirt did great things for my legs. Surely even a guardian wasn't immune to that. Well, apparently he was. His hard expression showed that my charms weren't working. Still, I figured I might as well try my luck with him on getting intel. "I'm trying to find a town in Siberia. A town where Dompiers live. Do you know it?" He didn't blink.
"No."
Wonderful. Both were playing difficult. "Yeah, well, maybe your boss does?" I asked demurely, hoping I sounded like an aspiring blood whore. If the Dompiers wouldn't talk, maybe one of the Maroi would. Maybe he wants some company and would talk to me.
"He already has company," the guardian replied evenly. "He doesn't need any more."
I kept the smile on. "Are you sure?" I purred. "Maybe we should ask him."
"No," replied the guardian.
In that one word, I heard the challenge and the command. "Back off."
He wouldn't hesitate to take on anyone he thought was a threat to his master, even a lowly Dampierre girl. I considered pushing my case further, but quickly decided to follow the warning and indeed back off. I gave an unconcerned shrug. His loss. And with no other words, I walked casually back to my table like the rejection was no big deal. All the while, I held my breath, half expecting the guardian to drag me out of the club by my hair. It didn't happen. Yet as I gathered my coat and set some cash on the table, I saw him watching me, eyes wary and calculating. I left the Nightingale with that same nonchalant air, heading out toward the busy street. It was a Saturday night, and there were lots of other clubs and restaurants nearby. Partygoers filled the streets, some dressed as richly as the Nightingale's patrons. Others were my age and dressed in casual wear. Lines spilled out of the clubs, dance music loud and heavy with bass. Glass-fronted restaurants showed elegant diners and richly set tables. As I walked through the crowds, surrounded by rushing conversation, I resisted the urge to look behind me. I didn't want to raise any further suspicion if that Dampierre was watching. Yet when I turned down a quiet street that was a shortcut back to my hotel, I could hear the soft sounds of footsteps. I apparently had raised enough alarm that the guardian had decided to follow me. Well, there was no way I was going to let him get the drop on me. I might have been smaller than him, and wearing a dress and heels, but I had fought plenty of men, including Strigoi. I could handle this guy, especially if I used the element of surprise. After walking this neighborhood for so long, I knew it and its twists and turns well. I picked up my pace and darted around a few corners, one of which led me into a dark, deserted alley. Scary, yeah, but it made for a good ambush spot when I ducked into a doorway. I quietly stepped out of my high-heeled shoes. They were black with pretty leather straps, but not ideal in a fight, unless I planned on gouging someone in the eye with a heel. Actually, not a bad idea. But I wasn't quite that desperate. Without them, the pavement was cold beneath my bare feet since it had rained earlier in the day. I didn't have to wait long. A few moments later, I heard the footsteps and saw my pursuer's long shadow appear on the ground, cast in the flickering light of a street lamp on the adjacent road. My stalker came to a stop, no doubt searching for me. Really, I thought this guy was careless. No guardian in pursuit would have been so obvious. He should have moved with more stealth and not revealed himself so easily. Maybe the guardian training here in Russia wasn't as good as what I'd grown up with. No, that couldn't be true. Not with the way Dmitri had dispatched his enemies. They'd called him a god at the academy. My pursuer took a few more steps, and that's when I made my move. I leapt out, fists ready. "Okay," I exclaimed. "I only wanted to ask a few questions, so just back off or else." I froze. The guardian from the club wasn't standing there. A human was. A girl, no older than me. She was about my height, with cropped dark blonde hair and a navy blue trench coat that looked expensive. Underneath it, I could see nice dress pants and leather boots that looked as pricey as the coat. More startling still was that I recognized her. I'd seen her twice at the Nightingale talking to the Moroi men. I'd assumed she was just another of the women they liked to flirt with and had promptly dismissed her. After all, what use was a human to me? Her face was partly covered in shadow, but even in poor lighting I could make out her annoyed expression. That wasn't quite what I'd expected. "It's you, isn't it?" she asked. Cue more shock. Her English was as American as my own. "You're the one who's been leaving the string of Strigoi bodies around the city. I saw you back in the club tonight, and I knew it had to be you." No other words formed on my lips. I had no idea how to respond. A human talking casually about Strigoi? It was unheard of. This was almost more astonishing than actually running into a Strigoi out here. I'd never experienced anything like this in my life. She didn't seem to care about my stupefied state. "Look, you can't just do that, okay? Do you know what a pain in the ass it is for me to deal with? This internship is bad enough without you making a mess of it. The police found the body you left in the park, you know. You cannot even imagine how many strings I had to pull to cover that up." Who are you? I asked at last. It was true. I had left a body in the park, but seriously, what was I supposed to do? Drag him back to my hotel and tell the bellhop my friend had had too much to drink?
Sydney, the girl said warily.
My name's Sydney. I'm the alchemist assigned here.
The what?
She sighed loudly, and I was pretty sure she rolled her eyes.
Of course, that explains everything.
No, not really, I said, finally regaining my composure. In fact, I think you're the one who has a lot of explaining to do.
And attitude, too. Are you some kind of test they sent here for me?
Oh, man, that's it. I was getting angry now. I didn't like being chastised. I certainly didn't like being chastised by a human who made it sound like me killing Strigoi was a bad thing.
Look, I don't know who you are or how you know about any of this, but I'm not going to stand here and...
Nausea rolled over me, and I tensed, my hand immediately going for the silver stake I kept in my coat pocket. Sydney still wore that annoyed expression, but it was mingled with confusion now at the abrupt change in my posture. She was observant, I'd give her that.
What's wrong? She asked.
You're going to have another body to deal with? I said, just as the Strigoi attacked her.
Chapter 2.
Going for her instead of me was bad form on the Strigoi's part. I was the threat. He should have neutralized me first. Our positioning had put Sydney in his way, however, so he had to dispatch her before he could get to me. He grabbed her shoulder, jerking her to him. He was fast. They always were. But I was on my game tonight. A swift kick knocked him into a neighboring building's wall and freed Sydney from his grasp. He grunted on impact and slumped to the ground, stunned and surprised. It wasn't easy to get the drop on a Strigoi, not with their lightning-fast reflexes. Abandoning Sydney, he focused his attention on me, red eyes angry and lips curled back to show his fangs. He sprang up from his fall with that preternatural speed and lunged for me. I dodged him and attempted a punch that he dodged in return. His next blow caught me on the arm, and I stumbled, just barely keeping my balance. My stake was still clutched in my right hand, but I needed an opening to hit his chest. A smart Strigoi would have angled himself in a way that ruined the line of sight to his heart. This guy was only doing a so-so job, and if I could stay alive long enough, I'd likely get an opening. Just then, Sydney came up and hit him on the back. It wasn't a very strong blow, but it startled him. It was my opening. I sprinted as hard as I could, throwing my full weight at him. My stake pierced his heart as we slammed against the wall. It was as simple as that. The life, or undead life or whatever, faded away from him. He stopped moving. I jerked out my stake once I was certain he was dead, and watched as his body crumpled to the ground. Just like with every Strigoi I'd killed lately, I had a momentary surreal feeling. What if this had been Dimitri? I tried to imagine Dimitri's face on this Strigoi, tried to imagine him lying before me. My heart twisted in my chest. For a split second, the image was there. Then, gone. This was just some random Strigoi. I promptly shook the disorientation off and reminded myself that I had important things to worry about here. I had to check on Sydney. Even with a human, my protective nature couldn't help but kick in.
Are you okay?
She nodded, looking shaken but otherwise unharmed.
Nice work, she said.
She sounded as though she were forcibly trying to sound confident.
I've never actually seen one of them killed.
I couldn't imagine how she would have, but then I didn't get how she knew about any of this stuff in the first place. She looked like she was in shock, so I took her arm and started to lead her away. Come on, let's get out to where there's more people. Strigoi lurking near the Nightingale wasn't that crazy of an idea, the more I thought about it. What better place to stalk Maroi than at one of their hangouts? Though hopefully most guardians would have enough sense to keep their charges out of alleys like this. The suggestion of departure snapped Sydney out of her daze.
What? She exclaimed. You're just going to leave him too?
I threw up my hands. What do you expect me to do? I guess I can move him behind those trash cans and then let the sun incinerate him. That's what I usually do.
Right. And what if someone shows up to take out the trash, or comes out of one of these back doors? Well, I can hardly drag him off or set him on fire. A vampire barbecue would kind of attract some attention, don't you think?
Sydney shook her head in exasperation and walked over to the body. She made a face as she looked down at the Strigoi and reached into her large leather purse. From it, she produced a small vial. With a deft motion, she sprinkled the vial's contents over the body and then quickly stepped back. Where the drops had hit his corpse, yellow smoke began to curl away. The smoke slowly moved outward, spreading horizontally rather than vertically until it cocooned the Strigoi entirely. Then it contracted and contracted until it was nothing but a fist-sized ball. In a few seconds, the smoke drifted off entirely, leaving an innocuous pile of dust behind.
"You're welcome," said Sydney flatly, still giving me a disapproving look.
"What the hell was that?"
I exclaimed.
"My job? Can you please call me the next time this happens?"
She started to turn away.
"Wait! I can't call you. I have no idea who you are."
She glanced back at me and brushed blonde hair out of her face.
"Really? You're serious, aren't you? I thought you were all taught about us when you graduated."
"Oh, well, funny thing. I kind of, didn't graduate." Sydney's eyes widened.
"You took down one of those things, but never graduated?"
I shrugged, and she remained silent for several seconds. Finally, she sighed again and said,
"I guess we need to talk."
Did we ever? Meeting her had to be the strangest thing that had happened to me since coming to Russia. I wanted to know why she thought I should have been in contact with her and how she dissolved that Strigoi corpse. And, as we returned to the busy streets and walked toward a cafe she liked, it occurred to me that if she knew about the Moroi world, there might be a chance she also knew where Dmitri's village was. Dmitri. There he was again, popping back into my mind. I had no clue if he really would be lurking near his hometown, but I had nothing else to go on at this point. Again, that weird feeling came over me. My mind blurred Dmitri's face with that of the Strigoi I'd just killed. Pale skin, red-ringed eyes.
"No," I sternly told myself. "Don't focus on that yet. Don't panic."
Until I faced Dmitri the Strigoi, I would gain the most strength from remembering the Dmitri I loved, with his deep brown eyes, warm hands, fierce embrace.
"Are you okay? Whatever your name is?"
Sydney was staring at me strangely, and I realized we'd come to a halt in front of a restaurant. I didn't know what look I wore on my face, but it must have been enough to raise even her attention. Until now, my impression as we walked had been that she wanted to speak to me as little as possible.
Yeah, fine, I said brusquely, putting on my guardian face. "And I'm Rose. Is this the place?"
It was. The restaurant was bright and cheery, albeit a far cry from the Nightingale's opulence. We slid into a black leather, by which I mean fake plastic leather, booth, and I was delighted to see the menu had both American and Russian food. The listings were translated into English, and I nearly drooled when I saw fried chicken. I was starving after not eating at the club, and the thought of deep-fried meat was luxurious after weeks of cabbage dishes and so-called McDonald's. A waitress arrived, and Sydney ordered in fluent Russian, whereas I just pointed at the menu. Huh. Sydney was just full of surprises. Considering her harsh attitude, I expected her to interrogate me right away. But when the waitress left, Sydney remained quiet, simply playing with her napkin and avoiding eye contact. It was so strange. She was definitely uncomfortable around me. Even with the table between us, it was like she couldn't get far enough away. Yet her earlier outrage hadn't been faked, and she'd been adamant about me following whatever these rules of hers were. Well, she might have been playing coy, but I had no such hesitation about busting into uncomfortable topics. In fact, it was kind of my trademark.
"So, are you ready to tell me who you are and what's going on?"
Sydney looked up. Now that we were in brighter light, I could see that her eyes were brown. I also noticed she had an interesting tattoo on her lower left cheek. The ink looked like gold, something I'd never seen before. It was an elaborate design of flowers and leaves and was only really visible when she tilted her head certain ways so that the gold caught the light.
I told you, she said, I'm an alchemist.
And I told you I don't know what that is. Is it some Russian word?
It didn't sound like one. A half-smile played on her lips.
No, I take it you've never heard of alchemy either.
I shook my head, and she propped her chin up with her hand, eyes staring down at the table again. She swallowed, like she was bracing herself, and then a rush of words came out.
Back in the Middle Ages, there were these people who were convinced that if they found the right formula or magic, they could turn lead into gold. Unsurprisingly, they couldn't. This didn't stop them from pursuing all sorts of other mystical and supernatural stuff, and eventually they did find something magical.
She frowned.
Vampires.
I thought back to my Moroi history classes. The Middle Ages were when our kind really started pulling away from humans, hiding out and keeping to ourselves. That was the time when vampires truly became myth as far as the rest of the world was concerned, and even Moroi were regarded as monsters worth hunting. Sydney verified my thoughts.
And that was when the Moroi began to stay away. They had their magic, but humans were starting to outnumber them. We still do.
That almost brought a smile to her face. Moroi sometimes had trouble conceiving, whereas humans seemed to have too easy a time.
And the Moroi made a deal with the alchemists. If the alchemists would help Moroi and Dampiers and their society stay secret from humans, the Moroi would give us these.
She touched the golden tattoo.
What is that? I asked.
I mean, aside from the obvious.
She gently stroked it with her fingertips and didn't bother hiding the sarcasm when she spoke.
My guardian angel? It's actually gold and... She grimaced and dropped her hand.
Moroi blood charmed with water and earth.
What? My voice came out too loud, and some people in the restaurant turned to look at me.
Sydney continued speaking, her tone much lower, and very bitter.
I'm not thrilled about it, but it's our reward for helping you guys. The water and earth bind it to our skin and give us the same traits Moroi have. Well, a couple of them. I almost never get sick. I'll live a long life.
I guess that sounds good, I said uncertainly.
Maybe for some. We don't have a choice. This career is a family thing. It gets passed down. We all have to learn about Moroi and Dampiers. We work connections among humans that let us cover up for you since we can move around more freely. We've got tricks and techniques to get rid of Strigoi bodies, like that potion you saw. In return, though, we want to stay apart from you as much as we can. Which is why most Dampiers aren't told about us until they graduate. And Moroi, hardly ever.
She abruptly stopped.
I guess the lesson was over.
My head was reeling. I had never, never considered anything like this.
Wait, had I?
Most of my education had emphasized the physical aspects of being a guardian. Watchfulness, combat, etc. Yet every so often I'd heard vague references to those out in the human world who would help hide Moroi or get them out of weird and dangerous situations. I'd never thought much about it or heard the term alchemist. If I had stayed in school, maybe I would have. This probably wasn't an idea I should have suggested, but my nature couldn't help it.
Why keep the charm to yourselves? Why not share it with the human world?
Because there's an extra part to its power. It stops us from speaking about your kind in a way that would endanger or expose them.
A charm that bound them from speaking. That sounded suspiciously like compulsion.
All Moroi could use compulsion a little, and most could put some of their magic into objects to give them certain properties. Moroi magic had changed over the years, and compulsion was regarded as an immoral thing now. I was guessing this tattoo was an old, old spell that had come down through the centuries. I replayed the rest of what Sydney had said, more questions spinning in my head.
Why? Why do you want to stay away from us? I mean, not that I'm looking to become BFFs or anything.
Because it's our duty to God to protect the rest of humanity from evil creatures of the night.
Absent-mindedly, her hand went to something at her neck. It was mostly covered by her jacket, but a parting of her collar briefly revealed a golden cross.
My initial reaction to that was unease, seeing as I wasn't very religious. In fact, I was never entirely comfortable around those who were hardcore believers. 30 seconds later, the full impact of the rest of her words sank in.
"Wait a minute," I exclaimed indignantly. "Are you talking about all of us, Dompierre's and Maroy? We're all evil creatures of the night?"
Her hands dropped from the cross, and she didn't respond.
"We're not like Strigoi," I snapped.
Her face stayed bland.
"Maroy drink blood. Dompierres are the unnatural offspring of them and humans."
No one had ever called me unnatural before, except for the time I put ketchup on a taco. But seriously, we'd been out of salsa, so what else was I supposed to do?
"Maroy and Dompierres are not evil," I told Sydney. "Not like Strigoi."
"That's true," she conceded. "Strigoi are more evil."
"Hey, that's not what I..."
The food arrived just then, and the fried chicken was almost enough to distract me from the outrage of being compared to a Strigoi. Mostly all it did was delay me from responding immediately to her claims, and I bit into the golden crust and nearly melted then and there. Sydney had ordered a cheeseburger and fries and nibbled her food delicately. After taking down an entire chicken leg, I was finally able to resume the argument.
"We're not like Strigoi at all. Maroy don't kill. You have no reason to be afraid of us."
Again, I wasn't keen on cozying up to humans. None of my kind were, not with the way humans tended to be trigger-happy and ready to experiment on anything they didn't understand.
"Any human who learns about you will inevitably learn about Strigoi," she said.
She was playing with her fries, but not actually eating them.
"Knowing about Strigoi might enable humans to protect themselves, though."
Why the hell was I playing devil's advocate here? She finished toying with a fry and dropped it back on her plate.
"Perhaps. But there are a lot of people who would be tempted by the thought of immortality, even at the cost of serving Strigoi in exchange for being turned into a creature from hell. You'd be surprised at how a lot of humans respond when they learn about vampires. Immortality's a big draw, despite the evil that goes with it. A lot of humans who learn about Strigoi will try to serve them in the hopes of eventually being turned."
"That's insane!" I stopped. "Last year, we discovered evidence of humans helping Strigoi. Strigoi couldn't touch silver stakes, but humans could, and some had used those stakes to shatter Maroy wards. Had those humans been promised immortality?"
"And so," said Sydney, "that's why it's best if we just make sure no one knows about any of you. You're out there, all of you, and there's nothing to be done about it. You do your thing to get rid of Strigoi, and we'll do ours and save the rest of my kind."
I chewed on a chicken wing and restrained myself from the implied meaning that she was saving her kind from people like me, too. In some ways, what she was saying made sense. It wasn't possible that we could always move through the world invisibly. And yes, I could admit, it was necessary for someone to dispose of Strigoi bodies. Humans working with Maroy were an ideal choice. Such humans would be able to move around the world freely, particularly if they had the kinds of contacts and connections she kept implying.
I froze mid-chew, remembering my earlier thoughts when I'd first come along with Sydney.
I forced myself to swallow and then took a long drink of water.
"Here's a question. Do you have contacts all over Russia?"
"Unfortunately," she said. "When alchemists turn 18, we're sent on an internship to get first-hand experience in the trade and make all sorts of connections. I would have rather stayed in Utah."
That was almost crazier than everything else she told me, but I didn't push it.
"What kind of connections, exactly?"
She shrugged.
"We track the movements of a lot of Maroy and Dompierres. We also know a lot of high-ranking government officials, among humans and Maroy. If there's been a vampire sighting among humans, we can usually find someone important who can pay someone off or whatever. It all gets swept under the rug."
"Track the movements of a lot of Maroy and Dompierres."
"Jackpot."
I leaned in close and lowered my voice. Everything seemed to hinge on this moment.
"I'm looking for a village. A village of Dompierres out in Siberia. I don't know its name."
Dmitri had only ever mentioned its name once, and I'd forgotten.
"It's kind of near...
Omsk," she corrected. I straightened up. "Do you know it?"
She didn't answer right away, but her eyes betrayed her.
Maybe.
You do, I exclaimed. You have to tell me where it is. I have to get there. She made a face.
Are you going to be one of those?
So Alchemist knew about Bloodhorse. No surprise. If Sydney and her associates knew everything else about the vampire world, they'd know this too.
No, I said haughtily. I just have to find someone.
Who?
Someone. It almost made her smile. Her brown eyes were thoughtful as she munched on another fry. She'd only taken 2 bites out of her cheeseburger, and it was rapidly growing cold. I kind of wanted to eat it myself on principle.
I'll be right back, she said abruptly.
She stood up and strode across to a quiet corner of the cafe.
Producing a cell phone from that magic purse of hers, she turned it back to the room and made a call.
I'd polished off my chicken by then and helped myself to some of her fries since it was looking less and less like she was going to do anything with them. As I ate, I pondered the possibilities before me, wondering if finding Dimitri's town would really be this simple. And once I was there, would it be simple then? Would he be there living in the shadows and hunting prey? And when faced with him, could I really drive my stake into his heart? That unwanted image came to me again. Dimitri with red eyes and...
Rose?
I blinked. I'd totally spaced out and Sydney was back. She slid back into her spot across from me.
So it looks like...
She paused and looked down.
Did you eat some of my fries?
I had no clue how she knew, seeing as it was such a huge stack. I'd barely made a dent. Figuring me stealing fries would count as further evidence of being an evil creature of the night, I said glibly.
No. She frowned a moment, considering, and then said, I do know where this town is. I've been there before.
I straightened up. Holy crap! This was actually going to happen after all these weeks of searching. Sydney would tell me where this place was, and I could go and try to close this horrible chapter in my life.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
She held up a hand to silence me, and I noticed then how miserable she looked.
But I'm not going to tell you where it is.
My mouth gaped.
What? I'm going to take you there myself.
Chapter 3
Wait, what? I exclaimed. That wasn't in the plan. That wasn't in the plan at all.
I was trying to move through Russia in as incognito a way as possible. Plus, I didn't really relish the thought of having a tag-along, particularly one who appeared to hate me. I didn't know how long it would take to get to Siberia. A couple days, I thought. And I couldn't imagine spending them listening to Sydney talk about what an unnatural, evil being I was. Swallowing my outrage, I attempted reason. After all, I was asking a favor here.
That's not necessary, I said, forcing a smile. It's nice of you to offer, but I don't want to inconvenience you.
Well, she replied dryly, there's no getting around that. And it's not me being nice. It's not even my choice. It's an order from my superiors.
It still sounds like a pain in the ass for you. Why don't you just tell me where it is and blow them off?
You obviously don't know the people I work for.
Don't need to. I ignore authority all the time. It's not hard once you get used to it.
Yeah? How's that working out for you with finding this village? She asked mockingly.
Look, if you want to get there, this is the only way.
Well, it was the only way I could get there if I used Sydney for information. I could always go back to staking out the Nightingale, but it had taken me this long to get a lead from there. Meanwhile, she was right here in front of me with the information I needed.
Why? I asked. Why do you have to go too?
I can't tell you that. Bottom line, they told me to.
Lovely. I eyed her, trying to figure out what was going on here. Why on earth would anyone, let alone humans with their hands in the Moroi world, care where one teenage Dompierre went? I didn't think Sydney had any ulterior motives, unless she was a very, very good actress. Yet clearly the people she answered to had an agenda, and I didn't like playing into anyone's plan. At the same time, I was anxious to get on with this.
Each day that passed was another in which I didn't find Dimitri. "How soon can we leave?" I asked at last. Sydney, I decided, was a paper pusher. She'd shown no real skill in tracking me earlier. Surely it wouldn't be that hard to ditch her once we were near enough to Dimitri's town. She looked kind of disappointed at my response, almost as though she hoped I would decline and then she'd be off the hook. She didn't want to come with me any more than I wanted her to. Opening her purse, she took out her cell phone again, fiddled with it a couple of minutes, and finally produced some train times. She showed me the schedule for the next day.
"Does that work for you?"
I studied the screen and nodded. "I know where that station is. I can be there."
"Okay."
She stood up and tossed some cash on the table.
"I'll see you tomorrow."
She started to walk away and then glanced back at me. "Oh, and you can have the rest of my fries." When I first came to Russia, I stayed in youth hostels. I'd certainly had the money to stay elsewhere, but I wanted to remain under the radar. Besides, luxury hadn't really been the first thing on my mind. When I began going to the Nightingale, however, I found I could hardly return to a boarding house of backpacking students while wearing a designer dress. So I was now staying at a posh hotel, complete with guys who always held the doors open and a marble-floored lobby. That lobby was so big that I think an entire hostel could have fit in it. Maybe two hostels. My room was large and overdone, too, and I was grateful to reach it and change out of the heels and dress. I realized with only a small pang of regret that I'd have to leave the dresses I'd bought in St. Petersburg behind. I wanted to keep my luggage light while jaunting around the country, and even if my backpack was large, there was only so much I could carry. Oh well, those dresses would make some cleaning woman's day, no doubt. The only bit of ornamentation I really needed was my Nazar, a pendant that looked like a blue eye. It had been a gift from my mother, which had in turn been a gift from my father. I always wore it around my neck. Our train from Moscow left late in the morning, and we would then catch a cross-country train to Siberia. I wanted to be well-rested and ready for it all. Once in my pajamas, I snuggled under the bed's heavy comforter and hoped sleep would come soon. Instead, my mind spun with all the things that had happened recently. The Sydney situation was a bizarre twist, but one I could handle. As long as we stuck to public transportation, she could hardly lead me into the clutches of her mysterious superiors. And from what she'd said about our travel time, it would indeed only take a couple of days or so to reach the village. 2 days seemed both impossibly long and impossibly short. It meant I could very well be confronting Dimitri in a few days. And then what? Could I do it? Could I bring myself to kill him? And even if I decided I could, would I actually have the skill to overpower him? The same questions that I'd been asking myself for the last 2 weeks kept plaguing me over and over. Dimitri had taught me everything I knew, and with enhanced Dragoi reflexes, he would truly be the god I'd always joked he was. Death was a very real possibility for me. But worrying wasn't helpful right now, and, looking over at the clock in the room, I discovered I'd been lying awake for almost an hour. That was no good. I needed to be in peak condition. So I did something I knew I shouldn't do, but which always worked to get my mind off my worries, largely because it involved me being in someone else's mind. Slipping inside Lissa's head required only a small amount of concentration on my part. I hadn't known if I could do it when we were far apart, but I discovered the process was no different than if I were standing right beside her. It was late morning back in Montana, and Lissa had no classes today since it was Saturday. During my time away, I'd worked very hard to put up mental walls between us, almost completely blocking her and her feelings out. Now, inside her, all the barriers were down, and her emotions hit me like a tidal wave. She was pissed off. Really pissed off.
"Why does she think she can just snap her fingers and get me to go anywhere she wants, anytime she wants?"
Lissa growled. "Because she's the queen and because you made a deal with the devil." Lissa and her boyfriend Christian were lounging in the attic of the school's chapel. As soon as I recognized the surroundings, I nearly pulled out of her head. The two of them had had way too many romantic encounters up here, and I didn't want to snick around if clothes were going to be ripped off soon. Fortunately, or perhaps not, Her annoyed feelings told me there'd be no sex today, not with her bad mood.
It was kind of ironic, actually. Their roles were reversed. Lissa was the raging one while Christian remained cool and collected, trying to appear calm for her sake. He sat on the floor, leaning up against the wall, while she sat in front of him, his legs apart and his arms holding her. She rested her head on his chest and sighed.
For the last few weeks, I've done everything she's asked. Vasilisa, please show this stupid visiting royal around campus. Vasilisa, please jump on a plane for the weekend so that I can introduce you to some boring officials here at court. Vasilisa, please put in some volunteer time with the younger students. It looks good.
Despite Lissa's frustration, I couldn't help a little amusement. She had Queen Tatiana's voice down perfectly.
You would have done that last one willingly, Christian pointed out.
Yeah, the point being willingly, I hate her trying to dictate every part of my life lately.
Christian leaned over and kissed her cheek. Like I said, you made a deal with the devil. You're her darling now. She wants to make sure you're making her look good. Lissa scowled. Although Maroi lived inside human-run countries and were subject to those governments, they were also ruled by a king or queen who came from one of the 12 royal Maroi families. Queen Tatiana, an Ivashkov, was the current ruler, and she'd taken a particular interest in Lissa as the last living member of the Dragomir family. As such, Tatiana had cut Lissa a deal. If Lissa lived at court after graduating from St. Vladimir's, the queen would arrange for her to attend Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. Lissa was a total brain and thought living in Tatiana's household would be worth it to attend a semi-big, prestigious university, as opposed to the tiny ones Maroi usually went to, for safety reasons. As Lissa was finding out, though, the strings attached to that deal were already in place now.
And I just sit and take it, Lissa said. I just smile and say, yes, your majesty, anything you want, your majesty.
Then tell her the deal's off. You'll be 18 in a couple of months. Royal or not, you're under no obligations. You don't need her to go to a big school. We'll just take off, you and me. Go to whatever college you want, or don't go to college at all. We can run off to Paris or something and work at a little cafe. Or sell bad art on the streets.
This actually made Lissa laugh, and she snuggled closer to Christian.
Right. I can totally see you having the patience to wait on people. You'd be fired your first day. Looks like the only way we'll survive is if I go to college and support us.
There are other ways to get to college, you know.
Yeah, but not to any that are this good, she said wistfully. Not easily, at least. This is the only way. I just wish I could have all this and stand up to her a little. Rose would.
Rose would have gotten herself arrested for treason the first time Tatiana asked her to do something.
Lissa smiled sadly.
Yeah, she would have.
The smile turned into a sigh.
I miss her so much.
Christian kissed her again.
I know.
This was a familiar conversation for them. One that never grew old because Lissa's feelings for me never faded.
She's okay, you know. Wherever she is, she's okay.
Lissa stared off into the attic's darkness. The only light came from a stained glass window that made the whole place look like a fairyland.
The space had been recently cleaned out.
By Dimitri and me, actually. It had only been a couple of months ago, but already dust and boxes were accumulating once more. The priest here was a nice guy, but kind of a pack rat. Lissa noticed none of this, though. Her thoughts were too focused on me.
I hope so. I wish I had some idea. Any idea where she is. I keep thinking that if anything happened to her, if she...
Lissa couldn't finish the thought.
Well, I keep thinking that I'd know somehow. That I'd feel it. I mean, I know the bond's one way. That's never changed, but... I'd have to know if something happened to her, right?
I don't know, said Christian. Maybe. Maybe not.
Any other guy would have said something overly sweet and comforting, assuring her that yes, yes, of course she'd know. But it was part of Christian's nature to be brutally honest. Lissa liked that about him. So did I. It didn't always make him a pleasant friend, but at least you knew he wasn't bullshitting you. She sighed again.
Adrian says she's okay. He visits her dreams. I'd give anything to be able to do that. My healing's getting better and better, and I've got the aura thing down, but no dreams yet.
Knowing Lissa missed me hurt almost more than if she'd completely written me off. I'd never wanted to hurt her. Even when I'd resented her for feeling like she was controlling my life, I'd never hated her. I loved her like a sister, and couldn't stand the thought of her suffering now on my behalf. How had things gotten so screwed up between us? She and Christian continued sitting there in comfortable silence, drawing strength and love from each other. They had what Dimitri and I had had, a sense of such oneness and familiarity that words often weren't needed. He ran his fingers through her hair, and while I couldn't see it so well through her own eyes, I could imagine the way that pale hair would gleam in the rainbow light of the stained glass windows. He tucked several